please lend your eyes and ears to Dr. Jordan Peterson.
Are there differences between men and women? Yes, Kermit, there are. Sorry, I'm not much of a puppeteer. So the first thing I've noticed, and I actually mentioned this at the University of Toronto debate, which some of you have probably watched, is that, I've been thinking about this for quite a while, is that there was an overwhelming majority of men in the room at the University of Toronto debate. And if you look around here today, you'll see that it's probably running, I would say, about 90-10. And that's quite remarkable, eh? Because there are more women than men in universities now. And so it's been quite interesting to me to see that at my public talks, the vast majority of people are men. And also the people that are watching on YouTube, it's about 90-10 as well. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, although I think maybe that nobody is actually speaking to men properly now. And maybe I'm doing a bit of that, and I would say that's probably also really good for women, because if men aren't doing very well, you can be sure that women aren't going to do very well. Because, as it turns out, we actually need each other. So, anyways, I'm going to start again a bit, I guess, by talking about Bill C-16 and why I made, you know, I made some videos back at the end of September, I suppose most of you know that. And one of them was expressing my concern about a piece of legislation that was put in at the federal level called Bill C-16. And what it purported to do was to add gender expression and gender identity to the list of protected groups, protected under the relevant human rights legislation, and also making harassment and discrimination something potentially addressable under the hate crimes provision of the criminal code. And on the surface of it, it's a very short bill, as it turns out, and on the surface it looks somewhat innocuous, although it's very badly formulated. And the first major error is, of course, the gender expression, which is fundamentally fashion choice, as defined by the Ontario Human Rights Commission websites. It's how you present yourself, in terms of your clothing and your fashion and your hair and makeup and that sort of thing in day-to-day activities. And it shouldn't be too unreasonable to point out that that does not constitute a group. And I'm actually a bit of a stickler when it comes to language. I think, especially when we're making legislation, that we should make laws that say exactly what they should say and nothing else. And since gender expression is not a group, it strikes me as very difficult to determine exactly how it's going to be added as a group to the protected groups under the relevant human rights code. But more than that, it's quite obvious, and I've talked to a number of people about this, so I know it's not just my imagination, that Bill C-16 and legislation like it are going to be interpreted in light of the policies that the Ontario Human Rights Commission has developed, and they are an absolutely incoherent set of policies if I've ever seen one. And that's why I made the first video. The second video I made because the University of Toronto, in its wisdom, the HR and equity people decided that it was okay to force their employees to undergo mandatory anti-unconscious bias retraining, which is something I have a big problem with, given that you can't diagnose someone's unconscious bias, first of all, and even if you could, there's no evidence whatsoever that unconscious bias retraining will help, and finally, there's no reason whatsoever why your employer, no matter who they are, should be messing about with the fundamental perceptual structures of your psyche, especially when they're looking at things that aren't even voluntary. So it's appalling on multiple dimensions. And one of the things I would seriously recommend to all of you is that if anybody starts to suggest that you need to undergo mandatory retraining for your unconscious racial biases, that if you go along with that, you're immediately admitting that you're the sort of bigot who needs to be retrained. And I would think very carefully about admitting that, because first of all, it's possible that it's not true. You know, I mean, people carry with them, everyone carries with them, certainly an in-group preference, that's quite common. What exactly that means in terms of their overt behavior or proclivities is completely undetermined by the relevant science. And there's absolutely no excuse for social psychologists to be putting forward tests like the implicit association test, which purport to measure unconscious bias as a diagnostic instrument, because they don't have the validity nor the reliability to be put forward as such. In fact, if you were a clinical psychologist and you were using tests of that sort to diagnose individuals, you'd be in violation of the statutes that are governing proper practice. So I have my reasons for objecting to these things. Huh? Now, what I really don't like about Bill C-16 and its surrounding policies is that it's put into our law a sequence of presuppositions that actually happen to be false. And it was me pointing out that they were false that's got me in whatever trouble I've been in and generated the accusations of such things as transphobia and racism, which are, I don't know how racism got into the picture at all. Well, I think it was because I complained about the insane individuals who were running Black Lives Matter in Toronto. And since I'm not a racist, I don't care if you're black or green. If you're crazy, I'm going to make the point that you're crazy. The two people who run Black Lives Matter are really reprehensible individuals, and so I was objecting to that, but I don't see how that makes me racist. With regards to being a transphobe, first of all, I object to the terminology because phobia has a very specific terminology, which is partly why I also object to the word Islamophobia, by the way, because phobia is a medical term, and you don't just get to pull medical terms away from their proper context and apply them to people whose political opinions you don't happen to agree with. It's misuse of language, it's misuse of medical terminology. And I would also like to tell all of you, just so you know, that there are a number of, first of all, there aren't that many transsexual people in the world, there aren't that many in Canada, and so whenever you hear from any of them, it's actually a reasonably substantial portion of the overall population. There are a lot of videos on YouTube put out by transsexual people, including a person I talked to in Vancouver, whose name is Theron Meyer, who state quite vociferously that they don't agree with any of the activists, the so-called trans activist political agenda that's being put forward as hypothetically representative of their group. First of all, they're not a group. The fact that you happen to have what would you say, gender dysphoria or an indeterminate gender identity does not make you a homogenous group. It certainly doesn't situate you such that some member of your group or some so-called ally, let's say, can stand up and purport to speak for you en masse as if you were a homogenous group. I mean, that's completely nonsensical. I mean, you can't talk to a man and assume that he speaks for all men. You can't talk to a black woman and have her say that she speaks for all black women. And you certainly can't stand up and say that because you're a transsexual, you speak for all transsexuals. It's partly why we have the idea of legitimate representation. And for people to legitimately represent a group, they have to have some legitimacy. Perhaps they have to be elected, at least they have to poll the people that they're purporting to represent, because you can't just come up and say it. It's inappropriate. And I've received 30 letters from transsexual people, and 29 of them were positive. And I can tell you why, with regards to what I've been doing. I can tell you why. The first is, they're not very happy with the idea that they're being represented by these noisy activist groups. Because they don't really, at each individual, because these were all individuals who wrote me, said that they're not happy about being represented in that manner, because that isn't how their political view of the world actually happens to lay itself out. In fact, most people who are transsexual are perfectly happy, for example, with the pronouns he and she. They just want to be called the other one. And so the people who want the gender-neutral pronouns say, are a very small minority of a very small minority. It's hard to say how many of them are, but the idea that they're somehow valid representatives of the whole group is absurd. They're also not very happy because they believe that because this has become such an issue, they're actually likely to face more prejudice rather than less prejudice, you know, because generally what people want, regardless of whatever kind of visible minority status they might have, what most people want is to live relatively peacefully and invisibly among other people. And so then whenever a political movement comes out to exaggerate or otherwise draw attention to the purported differences, there's real danger in that. So I'd like to put to rest the idea that somehow the trans activists who are accusing me of all the things they're accusing me of are somehow more legitimate representatives of transsexual identity and let's say well-being than I am. I don't believe that for a second. I've dealt with all sorts of people in my life, more than most people that you'll meet, that's for sure, and they've spanned every sort of person you can imagine, and I've worked hard to make all of their lives better, regardless of their particulars of their identity. And so to cast me as an enemy of an identifiable group, I believe, is completely absurd. And I think I can be confident in stating that, too, because I have the good fortune of having about 500 hours of my public statements to university students online. I tape everything now, everything that I say to students, pretty much, you know, at least in the classroom. And if there is anything even remotely reprehensible in any of that content, you can be sure that someone would have hauled it out and put it on YouTube with big exclamation points around it, and that I would have been called properly to task for it. And none of that has happened at all. And the reason for that is that there isn't any of it, none of it exists. So I'm not saying that I'm completely without bias. You have to be a fool to say that. And, you know, everyone is biased in their perceptions to some degree, but that's not the point. That doesn't mean you're racially biased or that you're racist. It means that you have your own particular viewpoint, and that comes with the idiosyncrasies and peculiarities of your character and your ethnic heritage and your race and your culture and all of that. So I'm not going to say for a moment that I don't have my own viewpoint, because I do, but I certainly think that the comments directed at me that you're trying to tar me with some of these half-witted epithets that are continually directed at me are completely without any standing whatsoever. So, all right, so let's go into the background of Bill C-16 and why I objected to it. So I looked quite deeply into the legislation as it was originally formulated in Ontario, and that was the legislation that was designed to provide protection for people whose gender identities, let's say, were non-standard. And the original legislation wasn't too bad. You know, it basically attempted to do perhaps what it should have if it was going to be reasonable, and merely add, let's say, the people who had non-standard gender identities to the list of protected groups. And they actually defined the non-standard gender identity fairly carefully, you know. But they shot the legislation out to activist groups, and what happened was that by the time everybody and their dog, so to speak, had their shot at modifying the original terminology, it was an absolute mess. And it's an absolute mess now, and I'm going to tell you why, and also why it's dangerous. The first thing, in the policies that surround Bill C-16, there's a claim that's been instantiated in the law in Ontario, and will soon be instantiated in the law in Canada, and that is, and it's a technical claim, and you need to pay attention to it because the technicalities matter. So the claim is that biological sex, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual proclivity vary independently. And that's a false claim. Now, that's actually what I said in the original video, and that's why people originally and still accused me of denying the existence of transsexual people. Well, there's no point in doing that, because obviously transsexual people exist, and they've existed for a very long period of time. But that has very little to do with whether or not biological sex, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual proclivity are independent, and they are certainly not independent. They're not even close to independent. They're so highly correlated that the correlation is almost perfect. And these things matter when you put them into legal framework. And so what's really happened is, because the social constructionist types have lost the intellectual battle as the biological evidence for the grounding of identity has become stronger and stronger over the last 50 years, because they've lost the scientific argument, they've taken the back door and they're trying to instantiate it legally. It's not going to work, because you can't make false facts law. I mean, you can hurt people by doing that, you can cause all sorts of trouble, but it isn't going to work for any length of time. So let's take apart the claim. First of all, the first claim is that biological sex and gender identity are actually different. And, you know, you can make a case for that in a weak way, because there is quite a range of personality expression, let's say, and interests among people who have the same biological sex. So there are masculine women, let's say, and there are feminine men. And there's quite an overlap, although you can distinguish the genders quite accurately using nothing but personality information and interest. So you can separate them even at the level where there is some similarity. But so you can make a weak case for that, but it's difficult to make a strong case. And the reason for that is that virtually every person whose biological sex is male expresses themselves in male, or has an identity that's male. It's only about 1 in 300 people for whom that identity differs. Now, you can say, well, that's because the degree of gender what would you say, amorphousness has been suppressed by sociological phenomena. I suppose that's true to some degree, but it doesn't matter. It's still going to be a very tiny minority. It's never going to exceed more than 1%, I don't think. And so what that means is that 99% of people have the same gender identity as biological sex. So how is that independent? It's the very opposite of independent. So it's wrong. It's as simple as that. And then, now that doesn't mean there aren't people who don't, where those two identities don't match, and those are the transsexual people, obviously. But to extract from that the statement that those vary independently is an intellectual sleight of hand. And it's really being pushed forward by people who are radical social constructionists who believe that every single aspect of human identity is determined by culture. And that's patently false. And not only that, it's dangerous politically, because one of the ideas that characterized the most reprehensible movements of the 20th century was that human beings could be molded in any manner possible by the state, that we didn't have an intrinsic identity of any sort, and that we were only creatures of culture. And that's not the case. There's a very distinct human identity, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as this talk progresses. Okay, so gender identity and biological sex do not vary independently. That's the first thing. Then the next claim is, well, let's move to gender expression. Well, you can dress in any manner you want. You can express yourself in a feminine manner, culturally speaking, if you're male, or you can express yourself in a masculine manner, culturally speaking, if you're female. But the truth of the matter is that the vast majority of people whose biological sex is male and whose gender identity is male present themselves in their fashion choices as male. And the same can be said about females. So the notion that there's independence there is also incorrect. They can vary, but they don't vary independently. And finally, with regards to sexual proclivity, the vast majority of people who are male, who identify as male, who present themselves as male, are also heterosexual. And that doesn't mean that there are no people who are homosexual. The percentage varies, but it looks like it's somewhere between 2 and 5%, or maybe between 1 and 5%, depending on the statistics. But that means that at least 95% of people who are male, who identify as male, and who present themselves as male, are also heterosexual. So, those four levels of analysis do not vary independently. And that's that. So the law is incorrect, it's badly formulated, and it's poorly put forward, and that's what I was objecting to. Now, it's worse than that, as far as I can tell, because of the social constructionist element. And the social constructionist element is the insistence that all of those things are culturally constructed. And they're not. So let's do that a bit. Let's review that a little bit. It's like elementary biology, I suppose. What's different between men and women? All right. Well, there's a variety of things. You know, the classic human embryological form is female, XX or XY, and the males are masculinized in utero by testosterone. So that's the first difference. And testosterone exposure in utero has quite profound effects on all sorts of later phenomena, psychological and physical. So for example, one of the things that higher levels of testosterone in utero seem to predict is less interest in people and more interest in things. And so, and that's been well documented by research teams in the UK in particular. But in any case, so the standard female morphology is female, but it's translated into male morphology by testosterone. And so then what do you get for standard morphological transformations? Well, there's the evident genetic ones, speaking technically. Obviously, male and female genitalia differ substantially, as you all no doubt know. There is some variation in that, although it's very rare. And then there are also other differences that kick forward, especially when puberty hits. And some of those are physiological and some of them are psychological. So one of the things that you see happening, for example, is that there aren't very large personality differences between boys and girls before puberty with regards to negative emotion. So that's trait neuroticism, for those of you who are interested in big five trait terminology. And so people who are higher in neuroticism are more sensitive to anxiety and emotional pain. And women are more sensitive than men to anxiety and emotional pain on average. And the effect isn't massive, it's about a third to half a standard deviation. But it's massive enough so that if you look at the end of the distributions, where the extreme people are, almost all the people who have extreme problems with anxiety and emotional pain are women. It's running about 4-1 in terms of depression and anxiety disorder diagnosis worldwide. And there's no evidence that that's cultural. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, so to speak, there are male pathologies as well. So males are much more likely to manifest antisocial personality disorder. They're much more likely to be characterized by alcoholism. And they're also much more likely to manifest attention deficit disorder and various learning disabilities. And so that also seems to be biologically predicated to a large degree. So, and interestingly enough, those differences, the personality differences between men and women with regards to trait negative emotion emerge at puberty. Well, why? Well, let's think about it for a minute. Now, these are speculations, but you can think about them and tell me what you think. I mean, they're reasonably grounded speculations, but I'm not certainly going to state them as fact, although I would say that the idea that these differences in personality between men and women exist, that's fact. How large those differences are and precisely what they consist of is still subject to some investigation, but it's extraordinarily well documented. So, what happens to men and women at puberty? Well, the men get bigger, they get stronger, especially in their upper bodies. And human beings are quite aggressive. We're predators as well as prey animals. And one of the ways that we defend ourselves aggressively is using upper body strength. So we punch, like kangaroos. There's other animals that do that. So, and we punch. And so what that means is that men are quite a bit more dangerous than women in, say, hand-to-hand combat. And that's actually a real problem. You see that manifest itself in part in a strange statistic, because it will come as news to most of you, but wives hit their husbands more often than husbands hit their wives, quite a lot actually. But it's a misleading statistic to some degree, because women lack upper body strength, they can hit their husbands and they're not really going to hurt them that much. I mean, there are men who are abused, and I'm not trying to make light of that. But one of the problems with having much higher upper body strength is that if you hit someone, you're liable to hurt them. And so male aggression in the context of a dyadic relationship, physical aggression, is much more likely to be dangerous or lethal than female aggression of the same sort. And it's part of the reason I think that women are more likely to hit their husbands, or wives are more likely to hit their husbands than the reverse, is because both the wives and the husbands know perfectly well that the wife is going to hurt the husband that much, so there isn't as much inhibition against the aggression. Okay, so now what does it mean for women that men are stronger than them starting at puberty? It means that women are at a disadvantage in physical combat, and that's part of the reason I think that their nervous systems make them more nervous, more anxious, and more susceptible to emotional pain, is because the world's actually more dangerous for them. Now, the world's also more dangerous for women sexually. Now, that's self-evident. I don't really think I have to explain that. I hope no one is foolish enough to try to disagree with that. The reason that sex is more dangerous for women than it is for men, obviously, is because women can get pregnant. And that changes their life completely. I mean, they may choose to have an abortion, but that in itself is no trivial matter. And as soon as you have a child, and that child is dependent on you, then your whole life has changed. And in more traditional societies, if you had a sexual adventure outside of the standard traditional structures, and you ended up pregnant, then you are in serious trouble. And so for women to be more anxious and more susceptible to emotional pain because of their increased sexual vulnerability is perfectly reasonable. Then the final reason I think that women are more susceptible to anxiety and emotional pain than men is because, let me see now, I may have lost my train of thought for that. I'll have to come back to that for a moment. Oh yes, that's it. You know, it's not obvious to me that women's nervous systems are actually serve to function in the best interests of women. I think that they actually serve to function in the best interests of women and infants. Because if you think about our evolutionary past, and for that matter, our present, you know, you're quite a different creature when you're a single person, male or female, than you are when you're a female that has an infant, especially an infant that's under about 9 months old. Because human infants are unbelievably fragile. You know, they're born, in some sense, way before they should be, and that's part of an evolutionary problem, too, because our heads are so big that our babies have to be born very young compared to other mammals of our size, roughly speaking. The gestation period should be longer for human beings. And because our heads are so big, the babies have to come out early, and that makes them relatively underdeveloped. And so they need a tremendous amount of care. They're very fragile, and so it seems to be quite likely that Women's nervous systems are optimized so that they're more threat sensitive and more sensitive to emotional pain because they have to be more responsive to infants and they have to take care of them, especially in their most fragile state, and that would be in the first 9 months. And I think that tilts women's nervous systems hard in the direction of what men might regard as excessive negative emotionality. But you have to be sensitive to threat and danger if you're going to have an infant because they're very, very fragile. So I think those are the reasons. And there's lots of other personality differences between men and women. You know, I can give you a list of them, and these are well documented, and so you might as well know about them. There's not a lot of difference in men and women in terms of extroversion, if you look at extroversion as a whole. Extroversion is roughly the dimension that regulate, or the dimension of personality that's associated with positive emotion. And extroverted people are gregarious and enthusiastic and assertive. They like to party, they like to have a good time. The social environment is their environment. And extroversion breaks down into enthusiasm and assertiveness, and women are more enthusiastic, which means that not only do they have more negative emotion than men, they also have more positive emotion. And so, so that's the positive emotion dimension. The negative emotion dimension is neuroticism, as I said, somewhat unpleasantly named, I would guess, but it basically indexes anxiety and emotional pain, frustration, disappointment, grief, that sort of thing, all rolled on the same dimension. That breaks into volatility, and volatile people are rather irritable and withdrawal, and people who withdraw are less likely to do things that are threatening. And women are higher by about a third of a standard deviation in both of those. Agreeableness is the dimension that men and women differ on the most. And agreeable people, and this is, I think, the most fundamental dimension of maternality and that characterizes human beings. So agreeable people are compassionate and polite and warm and kind and giving. But it's easy to take advantage of them, and they're not that good at standing up for themselves. And actually, if you look at one of the things that predicts wage differential across time, male or female, is more agreeable people get paid less. And the reason for that is that often salary negotiations are zero sum. And if you're not aggressive, you don't get paid, because people aren't just going to give you money because they're going to be nice to you. That is not how it works. You generally have to fight for status and position and movement forward in careers. And in order to do that, you have to take a relatively, I would say, self-centered attitude, because the opposite, in some sense, the opposite of being agreeable is to be self-centered. And I'm also not saying that in a particularly negative way. There's advantages to being self-centered and to fight for your own territory, and men are more likely to do that. And you might say, well, what's your evidence that those differences in personality aren't culturally constructed? And the evidence for that is quite clear. You can go online, you can look up the Scandinavian studies. Just go online and look up gender differences in personality cross-culturally. You'll find the relevant studies. They've been done with tens of thousands of people. And what they've shown quite clearly is that in those societies where the most has been done to move the social world into a position of radical equality, and so that would roughly be the Scandinavian countries, because they've done more of that than any other country, the personality differences between men and women maximize. They don't minimize. They maximize. And I'll say that again. In the countries where the most has been done to equalize the playing field between men and women get more different rather than more the same. So for all you social constructionists out there in the audience, and there's probably not that many of you because you wouldn't come and hear me talk if you were a social constructionist, you're actually wrong. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, that so one of the things you might be interested in is that it's all the same to me in some sense. Like when I was looking into this to begin with, and this would have started probably 25 years ago, looking at differences in personality between men and women, you know, it wasn't obvious at all whether they were fundamentally biological or fundamentally sociological or what mix produced the differences. You know, no one knew. And the most logical hypothesis, really, I thought, was that as you equalized the society, that men and women would become more the same. But that is not what happened. And so we've actually put the social constructionist hypothesis with regards to gender differences in sex and personality, we put that to the test in a very intense way, and the social constructionist viewpoint failed. So it's very strange, because no one would have really believed that, right? You make society more the same, and men and women get more different. It's like, what's up with that? Well, the answer seems to be is that there's fundamentally two sources of variability in personality, right? There's perhaps more, but you can categorize them as roughly genetic and roughly sociological. Well, if you take out all the sociological differences between the landscape in which men and women are raised, all you have left are the biological and genetic differences. So they maximize. Well, that's exactly what happened. This actually matters. It really matters. And this is why the demands for equity are so, well, there's about 15 reasons why demands for equity border on this is between men and women should not be overlooked, partly because it's wrong to overlook the genuine differences between men and women. It's not good for the men, it's not good for the women. So one of the things you see in Scandinavia, for example, is there's an overwhelming preponderance of female nurses, and there's an overwhelming preponderance of male engineers. And actually, the data on personality differences, there's the standard traits, which I'll continue to go through. I can do that quite quickly. There's not much difference in trait conscientiousness between men and women. If you break it down into the aspects, women are a bit more orderly than men, but there's no difference in industriousness. And then with regards to openness, which is the intellect creativity dimension, overall there's no difference between men and women, but if you break it up into the aspects, then the differences are actually quite pronounced. So what you have is that openness to experience is the technical trait, and it roughly breaks down into something that's sort of like creativity and aesthetic interests versus interest in ideas. And what you see is that women are a third of the standard deviation higher than men in terms of creativity and aesthetic proclivity, let's say, and men are one third of the standard deviation higher than women in terms of interest in ideas. And it's not a trivial difference, and it makes a difference. So, but the biggest difference between men and women, as it turns out, and this is almost one standard deviation, which is a walloping difference. You never see that in social science. It's a massive difference. Is difference in interest. And the masculine interest, roughly speaking, is in things, and the female interest, roughly speaking, is in people. And that's what underlies the differences, say, in career choice preference between things like nursing and psychology and social work and that sort of thing, and engineering. And because engineering is perhaps the most male-oriented of all the disciplines, and the evidence that that's sociological is very, very weak. Now, I should also point out, because this is important, people have wondered for a long time if the differences between men and women, say with regards to the sciences and the engineering, had anything to do with intelligence. And the former president of Harvard, Larry Summers, got in terrible trouble at one point. In fact, I think he had to resign, because he made a very technical claim. He said that if you look at the distributions of intelligence for men and women, imagine you have a normal distribution, right? So almost everybody's at the average. There's some extremely intelligent people, but not very many. And there's some people who are very intellectually impaired, but not very many. If you map the distributions of men and women onto one another, there's two hypotheses. One hypothesis, roughly speaking, is that they're the same. And the evidence for that is reasonable, I would say. The other theory is that the means are the same, the mean is the same, so both men and women have an average IQ of 100, but the standard deviation is different. So it's larger in men than it is in women. And what that means is that if you go way the hell out into the hypergenius range, they're almost all men, but also if you go way the hell out into the range where people are incredibly intellectually impaired, they're also all men. And that's the increased male variability hypothesis. And you see increased male variability in a number of different species. Partly because men are more expendable than women. And the reason for that, biologically speaking, the reason for that is that, well, you don't need that many men to impregnate a lot of women, but, you know, you need women. Women are a bottleneck with regards to reproduction, and so every woman counts, although not every man counts. And that's true in many, many species. And so you see more variability in male behavior because of that across species frequently. And that comes often at a cost of increased male illness. And you know, look at it, guys. You're going to die about 8 years sooner than the typical woman. And that's partly the price you pay for running partly on testosterone, because it's quite toxic over the long run. So men do pay for their whatever advantages they might have. And they pay for that with a lifespan that's decreased by about 10%. It's a non-trivial disadvantage. But anyways, what Larry Summers said was, well, if the IQ distribution is flatter for men than for women, maybe one of the reasons that almost all the outstanding men in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics are male is because it takes a genius level, an IQ level of, say, 150 or 160 And when you get way out on the distributions, when the distributions differ like that, then there's massive differences at the ends. Now, he didn't say that was true, by the way. He said that that was one possibility. And by the way, it is one possibility, because nature doesn't arrange itself so that everything it presents to us is in keeping with what we would like to be true politically. In fact, quite the contrary. Now, I'm kind of agnostic with regards to that, because I've looked at the data on both sides, and I don't think that we can make a determinative statement about the differences in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, overrepresentation of men on the basis of variability and intelligence. But I do think we can make the case in terms of interest, because it is the case that the biggest differences that there are between men and women are differences in interest. And the question is, well, do we have a problem with that? Like, is that really a problem? Now, you know, you could set up your culture to eradicate those differences. You know, because you can make cultures very coercive. And so if you punish boys from the time they were born for being interested in things and insisted that they become more interested in people, then perhaps you could do that. It would come at some cost, and you could do the same thing to girls. You could make them less interested in people and more interested in things. But, you know, to the degree that those differences are real, and to the degree that they're actually grounded in biology, you're going to have to turn your society into something pretty damn tyrannical to produce those differences. So, do you want to do that? And if you do, well, why do you want to do it? Is it a big problem that men and women actually have different interests? And is it really that big a surprise? Is that something we want to eradicate? All right, but back to Bill C-16. Okay. The policies surrounding it are incorrect, and they're dangerous. And they're dangerous partly because they are predicated on the insistence that all of these levels of analysis with regards to human identity are socio-culturally constructed. And they're not, and there's implications for that too, because one of the things that's happening, and this is happening particularly with regards to the equity movements, I'll define equity for you. It used to be equality of opportunity, but it shifted to equity. And in many universities now, the human resources department is human resources and equity. They should be absolutely ashamed of themselves for that. It is absolutely appalling. It's reprehensible. I actually think, I won't say it, but there's almost no political stance that's more reprehensible than the stance that demands equity. It's very ill-informed, and it's been tried very many times in very many places. And the net result of pushing equity from a political perspective was not good. And if people had any sense of 20th century history at all, the first thing they'd realize is that political systems based on the notion of equity become murderous very, very rapidly. And so to diagnose... here's how you diagnose an organization as racist and pathological. So the first thing you do is pick your key dimensions of identity, and whatever they happen to be. The most common ones are gender, race, ethnicity, and sexual proclivity. Fine. But they're innumerable, right? That's one of the problems, is that you can continually subdivide people into different groups without end, and the groups are relevant, you know? So for example, if you were concerned with the representation, let's say, of Hispanic women, are you going to be equally concerned about the representation of Hispanic women from economically deprived backgrounds and from rich backgrounds, from privileged backgrounds? Is that reasonable? Or are you going to subdivide the Hispanic women into those who came from privileged and those who came from unprivileged backgrounds? Are you going to further subdivide them by, well, how about attractiveness? How about that? How about weight? How about that? How about IQ? How about disability? You know, you can fractionate populations endlessly with regards to their group identity. So that's one of the fundamental problems with the notion of equity, is because you can never attain it, because you can keep fractionating the groups. And so you're not going to attain equity. But apart from that, let's say that you just start with the major categories, you know, gender, ethnicity, race, and sexual proclivity. That's fine. So here's how you diagnose an organization to find out if the people who run it are unconscionably biased and prejudiced. You look at the strata of the organization, right, the power structure, Then you take each strata and you map it onto the demographics of the general population according to your particular way of breaking down that population, which we have to keep in mind. And if there's any lack of concordance between the general population and representation at each of those levels of the hierarchy, then you describe the whole hierarchy as unconscionably biased and racist. It's like, well, that's convenient, except that it's wrong. I mean, well, the thing is, you know, most organizations do have their share of bias for historical reasons and for reasons that are perhaps a lot more unseemly than historical reasons. But the idea that you can categorically state that every single difference at every single level of the hierarchy is a consequence of the racial bias and unseemly thoughts of everyone in the organization is an absolutely appalling thing to think. You know, it's a multivariate problem, right? Why are people represented differently in different organizations? Well, there's probably 20 reasons, not one. You can't just say, well, it's racism or it's prejudice. It's like, yeah, sure, yes, it's probably racism and it's probably prejudice. But that isn't the only reasons. There's lots of reasons, and you have to do a differentiated analysis, first of all, to understand them. And then you have to be very careful not to muck about stupidly with the organization to make it worse than it already is. And so the idea, and I mean, look, the University of Toronto HR department is teaching its employees this straight out. That's equity. If the organization doesn't produce a population equivalent outcome, then it's racist or sexist or whatever ist you want it to be. There's something wrong with it. And then, worse than that, everybody in the bloody organization needs to be re-educated. It's like, come on, that's just not, it's not sensible. And, well, not only is it not sensible, it's downright dangerous. And so that was the other reason that I made the videos to begin with, is because I don't believe that that's the least bit appropriate. And I think it takes our society down a very dangerous path. So, all right, so let's see, what else should I talk to you about? Oh yeah, so this was the last thing I was asked to talk about. So, we're in a rather chaotic political period right now, as you may have all noticed. That certainly manifested itself in the American election, which is still causing all sorts of perturbations. But you can see the same thing happening in, let's say, in Europe for the time being, right? What you see happening, roughly speaking, is that the divide between the left wing and the right wing is growing. And extremism on both ends is also growing. And really, that's not a good thing, because we've had extremist right-wing movements in the last 150 years, and we've had extremist left-wing movements, and they weren't pretty. And maybe we don't want to bring them back. And so we have a serious problem. All right, so let's take a look at that for a minute and look at it seriously. So let's look at the left. And so I'm going to tell you some things about the left. The first thing is that people vote their temperament. And you need to understand this, because when you're talking to people who are across the political divide from you, and I'm assuming they're relatively reasonable people, we're not going to talk about the extremists for a moment. If you're talking to people who are liberal or left-leaning, then you're talking to people who are high in trade openness and low in conscientiousness. Okay, and so that makes them, roughly speaking, interested in ideas and creative, but not very good at implementing things. And then people who are on the right are the opposite. They're low in openness, and they're high in conscientiousness. And that makes them not very good at thinking up new things, but pretty damn good at implementing things that already exist. And so the thing about that is that both of those ways of interacting with the world are necessary under different conditions. You know, sometimes you have a good idea and you're running on it, and what you need are people to implement the idea just as it is, efficiently and effectively and in an orderly manner. And away you go. But sometimes your efficient and orderly structure is not working anymore because the environment has changed dramatically around it, and you need troublemakers with new ideas to come in and break things up so that you start moving in a different direction. And you might ask yourself, well, when is the time for the chaos of the left, and when is the time for the order of the right? And the answer to that is, we don't know. And that's why we have to talk. Because the environment moves around on us, right? It's constantly shifting underneath our feet. And sometimes it shifts so that we have to shift to the left to stay in the middle. And sometimes it shifts so that we have to shift to the right to stay in the middle. And the only way we can figure that out is by having political dialogue. And that's part of the reason why I'm a strong free speech advocate, as if I should have to defend myself for such a foolish thing. No, obviously. freedom of speech, first of all, freedom of speech is the cornerstone of our civilization. I think I don't think it's reasonable to even have a debate about that. And I think the reason for that is that free speech is how people think. Now, you might think you think, but generally you don't. What you do is rehash temperamental prejudices over and over again in your mind. And you actually don't think much until you write for other people or until you talk to other people, because they make you think. Because your assumption is just going to be that you're correct, unless you can really think, and hardly any people can think. Because, you know, really, it's hard. In order to think, you have to fragment yourself up into multiple personalities, each of which hold an opposing perspective. And then you have to let those opposing perspectives have a battle in the theater of your imagination. That's a very difficult thing to do. And so don't confuse having your idiosyncratic prejudices with thinking. You have to be technically trained in order to think, and it's very uncomfortable and painful, and so people don't like it at all. So generally what you do, though, if you speak, is that you put forth your view of the world, perhaps in the best manner that you can, but also loaded with your own prejudices and biases, and your ignorance as well, because you have to speak from your restricted perspective, knowing as little as you do know, and with your personality, you know, first and foremost in your utterances. And then other people correct you. And hopefully you enter into a real dialogue whereby you can transcend your own biased limitations and expand the toolbox with which you use to work in the world. And everyone benefits from that. And then you modify your viewpoints so that they actually work better in the future. Because that's kind of what it means to have a useful and correct viewpoint is, do you have a toolbox that is going to enable you to work effectively in the world? And if you're too biased and too narrow and too ignorant, what that means is that your toolbox is only going to work in a very narrow environment. And if you go out into public and you hammer yourself up against other people, especially those who don't agree with you, you can formulate the problems more clearly. You can discuss the possibility for consensus, and then you can negotiate an implementation strategy. And the alternative to that is that you're silent, you're a slave, or you're a tyrant. That's it. We devolve into conflict and fighting. And that's not a good idea. And we don't have to do it, because we do actually know how to talk to each other. And although perhaps we forget very frequently why we should have to. You know, the other thing to think about is, you know, you don't exist just for who you are now. You also exist for who you're going to be next week and next month and next year and 5 years down the road and so on. And so you're actually a collection of people that extends out into the future. And so what that means is that you not only have to get along with yourself, you have to get along with all the people that you're going to be. And one of the ways to determine who those people that you're going to be are is to talk to other people around you, because you're actually a collective that extends across time. And insofar as you're only speaking for yourself right now, you're not speaking for yourself as you're distributed across time. But if you talk to a bunch of other people, then what you're doing is approximating yourself distributed across time. So it's actually even in your selfish best interest to talk to a bunch of other people, because they can help you represent yourself better than you're going to do it by yourself. And then, you know, I would also say that, well, there's other reasons that you want to talk to other people to get your toolbox in order, because we might want to say too, well, what should you be aiming for in your life? And I can tell you that, roughly speaking, if you're looking for something that will give your life meaning, that's actually quite straightforward as far as I've been able to tell. And this is where the nihilists have it so wrong that it's almost unbelievable. And as far as I'm concerned, fundamentally, they're just escaping from responsibility anyways. Even though they have perfectly rational arguments for their nihilism. It's like, everything's meaningless. It's like, no, first of all, no. Pain is not meaningless. You're never going to meet anyone who will ever tell you that their own pain is meaningless. So we can just forego the whole meaningless argument right off the bat. It's like, there may be no positive meaning in life, we could have a discussion about that, but self-evident negative meaning exists, and everyone knows it. And even someone who's anarchic and nihilistic to the core, you know, if you drive a spike through their hand, they're going to act like that has meaning. And since I'm an existentialist, yes. And look at how people act instead of what they say, and they'll act out the idea that that has meaning very, very rapidly. So we'll just go with that. Now, you might say, well, there's all sorts of suffering, and that's self-evident. And But that's not the kind of meaning that I believe doesn't exist. I believe that only positive meaning doesn't exist, which is, you know, a little on the negative side, I would say, to begin with. But I can understand it. People can have pretty dreadful lives, you know, and you can easily get yourself in a situation where it seems like there's nothing at all to your life except suffering. And that's what happens to people who become suicidal, for example, and it's no joke. And they have their reasons, man. You know, sometimes those people have been hurt in ways that are absolutely unimaginable. And so when they see a horizon that's full of nothing but suffering, you can't just wave that away. But I would say, the first thing we might hypothesize is that since pain is an unalterable fact of meaning, and certainly seems to be negative, that one of the things you might want to try to orient yourself in relationship to is the reduction of human suffering. You know, because I think that's the main goal. And, you know, the answer to what do you do about a child who's suffering in a concentration camp isn't who the hell's going to care in a million years, right? That's not the right answer. And if it's not the right answer in that situation, then perhaps it's not the right answer at all. And the right answer to who the hell's going to care anyways in a million years is why in the world would you frame the statement that idiotically? I mean, anybody, this is kind of a trick of the imagination in some sense. Anybody who's quick-witted can come up with a frame of reference that makes anything, that makes almost anything lack meaning within that frame of reference. Well, all that means to me is that you picked a stupid frame of reference, right? Why should you accept without doubt the consequence of your stupid algorithm? Who's going to care in a million years? Yeah, God. Really? You got to be able to do better than that if that's how you're going to wipe out meaning. Well, so what do you want for meaning? All right, reduce suffering. That'd be a good one. You could devote your life to that. And I would say, start locally. And I think this is the alternative to right-wing nationalism, which is too much order, and left-wing chaos, which is too much chaos. We don't want to go down that rabbit hole again, either of them. So what's the alternative? I thought about this for a very long time. It took me decades to come to this conclusion. The conclusion is that you straighten yourself out, and you do that humbly. There's this idea in the New Testament, which I get quite a kick out of, that you're not supposed to pray in public. It's a little more complicated than that, actually. You're not supposed to pray in public until you've like sorted out the dispute that you had with your brother, for example. I really like that idea, because what it means is that you shouldn't make a public display of your virtue until you've straightened up your damn life. And this is one of the things I really don't like about protests. And I really don't like the fact that university students are taught by their half-witted professors that the way that you change the world... You don't change the world by going and waving signs at people that you've defined as more evil than you. First of all, the probability that they're more evil than you is actually quite low. Because evil though they may be, you're in the same damn boat. And if you've divided the world up conveniently so that you can identify the innocent and the damned, or the oppressor and the oppressed, and you think that you're in the positive category, then the probability that you're part of the solution and not part of the problem is zero. So it's just not that easy. And the most profound people that I've ever read have said the same thing over and over. It's like the line between good and evil runs down the middle of every human heart. And the first thing that you're supposed to do is win that battle on your own territory. And that's no bloody joke. That's a difficult thing to do because it means that you have to recognize yourself as a perpetrator of great evil. And that is what you are. And that's a terrible thing for people to learn. You know, you look at the 20th century, and you think, well, who brought on the horrors of the communist systems and the horrors of the Nazi systems? The answer is people just like you. And that's the answer. And if you don't understand that and you think that answer is wrong, then you're not very wise. And it's not surprising because the price that you pay for wisdom is radical disillusionment and the confrontation with evil. And no one wants that, really. It's a terrible thing to confront. And that's because human beings are terrible creatures. Now, I think we're also absolutely remarkable creatures and wonderful creatures, but we have an unlimited capacity for brutality and evil, and every one of us carries it. And so what you do is you try to sort that out in your own life, and you start... I had a guy talk to me just a while back about his life hadn't been going very well, and he decided to put himself together. And he started doing this little ritual thing, which I thought was quite cool. He was kind of an isolated guy, very overweight guy. When I talked to him, he lost about 130 pounds, which was quite impressive. It was part of him putting himself together. But he started doing it by building. He had a bunch of Legos left over from his childhood. And the first thing he did, because he was feeling very nihilistic and hopeless, he found that he got a little bit of satisfaction out of building little things out of Legos, you know. And I thought, well, that was pretty interesting. And so he built a bunch of these things. And then he said, well, I got a bunch of these things built, and then I had to figure out how to organize them in the room they were in. And I thought, that's cool, because he started high resolution at the level of detail, you know, and was building something that was trivial. He knew that he was just playing a game. But then, as soon as he had a collection of those, then he had to sort out the space that he was going to organize them in. And then he figured out, well, he had to sort out the room that they were going to be in. So he started organizing and beautifying the room. And at the same time, he had modified his diet and he was putting himself together. And that's the right thing to do. That's the right thing to do. Is that there are responsibilities that are awaiting you, right, that are in your own grasp. And you know what they are. And this is also something that no one can preach to you about. It's something you have to decide for yourself. And you can do it quite straightforwardly. And it's something that I do on a regular basis. You sit down in the evening or in the morning and ask yourself, like you're asking someone that you want the answer from, like you really genuinely need to want to have the answer. You're not telling yourself. None of that. You're asking yourself. All right, there's a bunch of things about my life that aren't in order, that aren't together, and I know it, and they're making me suffer, and they're making me less than I am. And there's some of those things that are staring me right at the face, and I know what they are, and there's some of those that I can put in order today with a little bit of work, so that when I wake up tomorrow, the domain of my experience, which is basically being itself, the domain of my experience will be more pristine and better put together than it is today. If you ask yourself that, you'll find right away. You know what they are, five things that come up, bang, 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 and they'll all be things that aren't very heroic, they're kind of trivial, and that you've been avoiding. You've been avoiding them. Those are little dragons of chaos, those things. And you know, they're just little, but that's good because you're not much of a hero warrior, and so maybe little tiny dragons are all the ones that you've been put up with for now. You know, you sort those things out, and it'll, first of all, it'll order the being around you in a more pristine and productive way, and it'll make you just a little bit more focused and together. And what that'll mean is that the next thing you can do is ask yourself the same question, and the problems that will emerge will be slightly larger and more complex. And then you can try to put those in order, and that'll make everything around you more pristine and better put together, and it'll make you a little bit stronger and more clear-headed. And then another set of problems will emerge that's a little bit larger, and if you continue to do that, you know, you'll sort yourself out, you'll clean up your room, you'll put your house in order, and then you can start to work in the community. And by that time, you'll actually have some power and some self-confidence and some competence and some credence. And you'll be much less likely to stupidly hit something complicated with a stick and say that you fixed it. But you have to start low. You have to. Carl Jung said one of his very interesting phrases. He says that the reason that modern people can't see God is because they won't look low enough. I really like that. He's an extraordinarily wise person. And what he meant by that was something like what I'm telling you, is that the secret to your existence is right in front of you, and it manifests itself as all those things you know you should do, but you're avoiding. Because one of the things you might ask yourself is, of course you're useless and weak and miserable and cruel and all those horrible things, but partly that's because you're also not what you could be, and part of the reason for that is that you're not doing what you know you should be doing. So you might ask yourself, because this is a very interesting game, if you started doing the things that you know you should do, this is a discussion with your own conscience, if you started doing those things that you know you should do, and you did that diligently, what the hell would you be like in 10 years? Now that's an exciting game. That's an interesting game. And if you play that, you'll find that you're a hell of a lot more than you were, and that's something at least. You might not hit the pinnacles, but you're going to be a lot more than you are. And then, if you're not weak and miserable and wretched and suffering and dismal and self-pitying and all those things, you're going to be a lot less resentful. You're going to be a lot less brutal. You're going to be a lot less cruel to yourself and to other people. Well, that's a pretty good start. You know, even if you're not a positive force for good in the world, if you just weren't wretched and horrible, that would be a good initial contribution. No? I would say, too, there's a corollary that goes along with that. You could look at it this way. This is something that I tried to explain. I did a video on Pinocchio, a couple of videos about Pinocchio, which I've been quite fascinated by. because it's a very good illustration in popular culture of how archetypes manifest themselves and how people understand the archetypes, even if they don't know they understand them. Because Pinocchio is a very interesting movie, if you think about it. You know, you might ask, well, when modern people think about people going to church, they think, well, how can people believe those foolish superstitions? It's like, yeah, fair enough, good question. Well, what the hell do you think you're doing when you go to a movie? It's like, what are you doing? Here you are. I know you probably haven't seen Pinocchio lately, but whatever. You know, it's the same thing. You're an adult. You bring your five-year-old to see Pinocchio. And you're just as entranced as he is. And think about what you're doing. First of all, you know those are drawings. They're not real creatures. They're drawings. Second, they're about a puppet. A wooden puppet who actually happens to wander around, who is being guided through life by a cricket, whose highest goal is to fail for reasons no one can understand. And somehow that makes a fairy turn him into something that's real. It's like, that's strange, people, right? The fact that you're doing that is very peculiar. And it says something about what people are like. It means that we understand things that we don't know we understand. And so Pinocchio is it's a very interesting movie. I can tell you what its fundamental presupposition is. I'll just guide you through it very, very rapidly. So, the beginning of the movie, Geppetto, who's the archetype of the good father, by the way, which is an archetype that we've forgotten about, but it does exist because our culture isn't just a tyrannical patriarchy, as you can tell by the fact that we're warm and comfortable and we're not tearing each other to shreds at the moment, which is what you do in a state of absolute chaos, right? It's mayhem while you're freezing and starving. Right, and that isn't what we have. We have peace, and it's rare, and it's amazing that we have it, and we shouldn't take it for granted, because it's not the normal order of things. The normal order of things is destructive chaos, and if you're fortunate enough to live somewhere that's peaceful and productive, you should thank your lucky stars every second of your life. And if you don't do that, all it means is that you don't know anything about history, and you know nothing about human beings. Because things can get absolutely monstrous, and it happens all the time. And there's always a fraction of the population who thinks that's how they'd like things to be, and perhaps there's a fraction of you that's like that too. And I wouldn't nurture that fragment if I was you, unless you want to go where it will take you. And anyways, back to Pinocchio. Tell that he's got a warm house and it's full of toys and it's full of music boxes, and you know, he's got a little kitten and he's got a goldfish and he takes care of them, and so he's a good guy. He makes this puppet, and then he puts a mouth on the puppet, and that's the final act, so the puppet can have its capacity to speak. And that's what you want if you're a good father, is you want to take your son and you want to turn him into someone who can speak, right? Who can speak his soul. And so Geppetto puts a smile on his son's face and says, wouldn't it be wonderful if he could be a good boy? It's like, yeah, wouldn't it be wonderful, right? Because that's what you do if you're a good father, you think. Wouldn't it be possible if this puppet could actually become something genuine and independent with its own voice? Well, he says, that's unlikely, and goes off to bed. And then a star appears up in the window, and he wishes on a star. And you think, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to wish on a star? It's like, well, a star is the light that beckons in the darkness, right? And it's something transcendent. You look up into the night sky, and it's awe-inspiring. Whether you're religious or not, you're looking into the infinite. Well, you make a relationship with the infinite by wishing on a star. You raise your eyes above the horizon and point at the light that beckons in the darkness. And you say, I wish more than anything else that my son could become a real person. It's like, that's what you do if you're a good father. You don't want to make him into a slave. You don't want to be a tyrant. You don't want him to be a puppet. You want him to be something strong and independent. Well, so off Pinocchio goes out into the world, right? And he faces all these different moral problems. He's armed with his conscience. It turns out to be a bug, right? Well, why? Well, it's because things bug you, you know? Your conscience bugs you. And the reason that the conscience is Jiminy Cricket is because that's the same initials as Jesus Christ. And Jiminy Cricket is Southern U.S. slang for Jesus Christ. And no doubt the animators thought that was very comical. And I'll tell you that the bug is a very strange representation of Christ, that's for sure. Who would make him into a cricket? And he's also rather error-prone in the movie, so because the movie doesn't have precisely a formal Christian structure. But part of the reason, this took me a long time to figure out too, is that you have to have a dialogue with your conscience. But it has to be a dialogue, because it's actually not 100% right. It has to be something that you build by having a discussion with it across time, and that's actually what Pinocchio does with Jiminy Cricket as the movie progresses. Both the puppet and the conscience get wiser by banging themselves against the world. And the puppet has to resist the temptation of easy fame and celebrity. That's the first temptation, right? Because he's asked to be an actor, which is an easy way to be celebrity. It's like the Kardashians, right? It's status without responsibility or competence. And so that beckons as an attraction. And then he learns that lying is a very bad idea, right? That's why his nose grows, so he has to get that sorted out. And then he's asked to present himself as a victim of circumstances. That's what the fox and the coyote do. And when he decides that he's too ill to go back to school, they take him to Pleasure Island, where he's trained to be a jackass that works for slavers in the salt mines. Right. Well, not bad for animation, I would say. And then at the end of the movie, he tries to go back home because he's terribly lost and he's half jackass because the people at Pleasure Island have taught him to do nothing but bray, which I can't help but think offers, or what would you say, is an appalling parallel to what's happening to educate people who are being educated in modern universities, right? Which are increasingly playhouses where you're taught to bray. And you listen, I can't listen to protesters. It's just painful. It's this constant repetition of soulless nonsense. Chanted is because the protesters are trying to convince themselves even more desperately than they're trying to convince the people that they're talking to. So anyways, Pinocchio goes back home, half jackass and half dead, and he tries to find his father, but there's no going home, right? Not once you're an adult, once you're a young adult, you don't get to go back home because there isn't anyone there that can tell you what to do anymore. And so Pinocchio goes home and his father isn't there, and he finds out that he has to go to the bottom of chaos itself to rescue his father. And that's what we have to do, right? Because our civilization is in a state of crisis, and that was predicted long ago by people like Nietzsche and Dostoevsky. And part of what you're trying to do when you go to university is to go to the heart of darkness, right? To the place that terrifies you the most, and to find what values your culture really has. And that's what it means to go down to the bottom of the depths, to the thing that terrifies you the most, and to revivify your father. It's a very old story. The Egyptians were telling that story 4,000 years ago. It's one of the oldest stories of mankind. And so that's what you have to do. You unite yourself with your culture so that you're more than just a weak and simple-minded individual, right? You dedicate yourself to the study of what's great about the past, and you incorporate it so that there can be something to you. And then you bring your father back up to the surface so that the culture can see and live again. And then that makes you into a real individual. Well, that's the movie. Well, we watch it. We're captivated by it. Now it's time to understand it. It's time to understand it in an articulated and conscious manner, because it's too late for us to be unconscious anymore. And so we have Scylla and Charybdis. We have the chaos of the left. And the left says, well, we need to tear down structures because they oppress. It's like, well, obviously structures oppress because something's good at the top of a structure and not so good at the bottom. So if you have any value structure, it's going to privilege some things and exclude others. But if you scrap the value structures, then there's nothing to live for. So we can't do that. That's just chaos. And then the radical right says, back to the nation. It's like, really? You know, we went back to the nation a couple of times, and it doesn't really look that great. And part of the reason for that is that the purpose of the nation isn't the nation. The purpose of the nation is to produce citizens who transcend and rejuvenate the nation. And so the nation should be properly subordinated to the individual, right? To the divine individual, for that matter. And that's what we figured out in the West. Now, it isn't that we only figured that out in the West, but so far we've been fortunate enough to put it into reasonable practice in our political institutions, and thank God for that. At least it's worked somewhere, and we'd be completely foolish to give that up, because look at what it's provided us with. It's remarkable. We're free as we can be. That doesn't mean that we're happy, because freedom and happiness are not the same thing at all. But we did figure out that the state should be subordinate to the wisdom of the individual, to the sight and the wisdom of the individual. But that puts a heavier responsibility on everyone. That means you have to be the wise individual who can see and speak. That's your job. And if you do that, the thing that's so cool about that is, you know, you need a meaning in your life that enables you to bear the suffering of your life without becoming corrupted. That's the basic rule. And you have to build yourself into something that you can actually respect so that you can see yourself bearing that terrible existential burden properly. And then you don't lose hope and you don't lose meaning because you can see that you're strong enough to stand up underneath that burden. And then there's something about you that you can respect and that maybe other people can respect and that will help bring suffering in the world to an end and that will help people develop fully as individuals and that will enable us to avoid the dehumanizing, rigid, sterile uniformity of the nationalistic left and the appalling, chaotic, devouring chaos of the radical left. How about no? The individual. That's the secret to the world. And you're all individuals, and so you're all the secret to the world. And all you have to do to discover that is pick up your damn responsibility. Stop listening to people who keep burdening you with rights. How many goddamn rights do you want, man? It's like you need some responsibility. So pick it up. Open your eyes and learn how to make yourself articulate. And that way the world won't descend into the series of hells that it already descended into in the 20th century. I think, in principle, we have time for questions. Is that correct? Are you okay? So we'll start with you. Do you want to use the mic? Yeah. Okay. So I'd ask you to try to keep your questions relatively short. So see if you can get them articulated up to the point where they can be relatively concise.
Okay. So way earlier, we were talking about the idea that like there needs to be a distinction between gender and sex, and like, I'm not saying it right. Like, you mean how they are connected. You say they are connected, and I'm wondering, like, the idea that because we can find an example of them not being connected, that means that they necessarily aren't connected. Like, where does that idea come from?
It comes from wishful thinking. You know, I mean, it comes from, there's a deep wish underneath that, and the wish is that human nature could be infinitely malleable and that the state could determine the direction that that malleability should take. That's the underlying wish. Now, I suppose there's also a wish to some degree that we could all burst the bonds that define us, you know, in a particular way. But you've got to ask yourself if you really want to do that. One of the things I see happening to young people that I think is terrible is that they're asked to abandon their identity before they even have one. And so then they turn to these group identities, which are extraordinarily shallow. They're very, very shallow. How are you going to get through life being a transsexual? It's not an identity. I'm not saying there are no transsexuals. I'm not saying that. But you don't get through life as a black person. You don't get through life as a white person. You get through life by having a differentiated identity. That's the toolbox that you use to interact with others. And part of that means that you have to accept certain limitations on who you are. But you want those limitations because there's nothing worse than total freedom. It's like you drop someone out in the ocean. Right in the middle of the ocean, with no direction, and you say, you're free to swim any way you want. It's like, what are you going to do with that? You got to have an identity, you know? So,
yeah, that's good.
How about here?
All right, before I ask my question, I just want to say that I identify as royalty, and you have to address me as Your Highness, or else I'll push like this. In all seriousness, I'm actually a trans man, just so you know. My question is, if you think the English language already had a gender-neutral pronoun before this happened, do you think any of us would actually be here?
Well, so the question is about gender-neutral pronouns.
If the English language already had a gender-neutral pronoun, do you think any of us would be here?
Well, I think that the issues that we're discussing would have come up in another way. You know, because I think everyone knows that whatever we're talking about has very little to do with gender pronouns. I mean, and people have asked me why I chose to live or die, let's say, on that particular mountain. It's like, well, the answer to that is you have to pick some place that's actual to stand, right? And the problem with that is that it might be somewhat absurd. Well, even in a battle, you know, it's like, well, who cares if you take the next yard of ground? Why would you die over that? Well, when you think about it that way, fair enough, it's foolish. But you have to make the abstract concrete before you can actually engage with it. And so it just so happened that this was the issue. I do believe that if there were gender-neutral pronouns in English, then this would have just come up some other way. Because political correctness and the polarization between right and left were occurring long before this particular issue manifested itself. So, you, yes, with the glasses. I'll repeat the questions and then everybody can hear them. It'll be a little faster.
Just to start off, are you familiar with Girardian mimetic theory?
Yes.
Okay, so my question comes kind of on a bridge that what do you think mimetic theory's usefulness is in understanding our components that go into how violence is created? And then can you offer some examples of combating or opposing the norm of scapegoating individuals? Because if Girard is correct, and societies and social groups are strengthened in their violence towards scapegoats, how do we drive a wedge between them and overcome that?
Well, I think you have to scapegoat the right thing. You know, because there is malevolence in the world. You know, that's another thing that we've forgotten about in our modern parlance. You know, I've talked about evil for a very long period of time, and my colleagues tend to look askance at me because they don't believe in such a thing, and I think, well, first of all, yes, you do believe in it. Whether you say you do or not, if you don't, you've buried your head in the sand, unless you're willing to say, for example, I think it was Unit 791. You guys who doubt the existence of evil, you go online and read about Unit 791, and then you see what you think about that. And if I told you what was done in China before World War II by the Japanese scientific investigative squads, let's say, that's the sort of thing that the things that were done by that unit were so terrible that I would not discuss them before an audience without a trigger warning, because they would burn themselves into your imagination and you would never forget them for the rest of your life. And if you can investigate, I think it was 731, by the way, if you can investigate that and come to the conclusion that there's no such thing as evil, then that's fine. You go ahead and live that way and just see how far it gets you. So we need to localize malevolence. Look, and the other thing I want to tell you too is that people have encounters with malevolence in their lives, and it often produces post-traumatic stress disorder. So very frequently, soldiers develop post-traumatic stress disorder, not because of what they observe, but because of what they observe themselves doing. So they observe themselves doing something absolutely vicious on the battlefront, and they think, where did that come from? I didn't think that's who I was at all. It's like, yeah, you didn't think so because you were never in a situation like that. You never had a chance to reveal to yourself exactly what you were like. And then other people who develop post-traumatic stress disorder are often people who've had an encounter with someone who was truly malevolent, who really, truly wanted to hurt them. And there's no room in their philosophy of being for that sort of event or action. It just fragments them and they never recover, or they often never recover. They have to develop a fully fledged philosophy of evil in order to recover. To understand that there are people who are malevolent and that malevolence exists in the world. Well, you can put it on someone else and you can punish them for it and you can chase them away. And then you can pretend that it's gone, but it never goes away. And the right way to deal with it is to find the thing in you that's that and to work to comprehend and to control it. It also, one of the things that's very interesting about that is it also makes you extraordinarily tough if you do it. You know, and I can give you a pop culture example of that. I mean, so Harry Potter obviously has an enemy, right, and that's Voldemort. And if you can't see the figure, say, of Christ and Satan lurking behind those figures, then you're really not using your imagination to any great degree. They're archetypal figures, right? And the thing about Harry Potter is that the only reason that he can face Voldemort is because he's got a touch of evil inside of him. It's embedded inside of him. And that's extraordinarily useful to know that, because it's very useful to be a monster. Or more importantly, it's very useful to be able to be a monster. Because if you can't be a monster, you can't stand up for yourself or for anything else. So the trick is to take that monster inside of you and to incorporate it and to use it. And then you don't have to scapegoat other people. And you can constrain the spread of evil starting with yourself. And you know, the people that you admire, whether you're men or women, have exactly that capacity, because women do not like harmless men. They like dangerous men who are civilized. And men have no respect for harmless men. They like dangerous men who are civilized. And so the trick for men is to turn yourself into a dangerous man who's civilized. And I would say that the most dangerous man is the person who can speak properly. So, I mean, there's other forms of dangerousness. There's nothing wrong with physical prowess. There's nothing wrong with all of the multi-dimensional ways that you can learn to be dangerous. But the highest order danger is articulated speech. And well, for obvious reasons, it's speech moves the world. And so, get your scapegoats right. That's the trick. Yes.
So, you've spent a great deal of time talking about free speech and fighting against political correctness on campuses. In the United States, we've seen places like the University of Chicago that have taken a very clear stand against political correctness and forced free speech on campuses. In Canada, would you say that there are any universities in particular, and any particular university departments, that have done a good job in standing up for free speech and standing up against forced political correctness on campus?
Well, I would say in Canada, so the question is, that Jonathan Haidt and his people at the Heterodox Academy have attempted to rank order American universities in terms of their allegiance to classical ideals, Enlightenment ideals, but deeper than Enlightenment ideals are free speech and free discourse compared to social justice. And they put the University of Chicago at the top. And I think Brown was at the bottom, Brown University. Or at the top, if you're thinking about social justice, and then you're in Chicago. The question was, what do I think about Canadian universities? My answer to that would be, Canadian universities have done such a good job over the decades standing up for free speech that everyone just takes it for granted. But now, it's come under threat, and I think it's come under threat because the postmodern movement, which basically started in the 1970s and which is deeply nested inside a matrix of Marxism, by the account of the postmodernists themselves, poses a substantial threat to the very idea of free speech because they don't believe in free speech. You see, the postmodernists, you've got to understand, I'm not saying that every social justice activist is a committed postmodernist because most of them aren't educated enough to be that. And by saying that, I'm just saying that it takes a substantial amount of education before you're the incarnation of a political philosophy, right? You have to do a lot of reading. And so I would say, you know, Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida are fragmented up into their tiny little fractional subpersonalities. Yeah, like evil pieces of Voldemort's soul. That's exactly it. And then they're distributed among the people who are possessed by that ideology. And so if you take a particular someone who's hyper politically correct, you'd say, well, 95% of them is normal person and 5% of them is like Michel Foucault. It's the evil offspring of Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. But if you put 20 of them together in a mob, then you get the whole philosophy blasting forward at you. Well, what is the philosophy? What's the predicate of the philosophy? Well, it's quite straightforward. From the postmodernist perspective, value structures exclude. Which, of course, they do. But then they take it further. They say, well, that's the purpose of a value structure is to exclude. So if you're in a value structure, a hierarchy, let's say, and you happen to occupy one of the top positions, then you're privileged for doing that. But the reason that the value structure exists and that you fight for it is because it privileges you, and it does that in part by excluding people. It's like, no, that's pushing it a bit too far. It's like value structures exclude, and they have to, because they're not value structures if they don't exclude. But to move from that to say that the only reason value structures exist is to exclude is palpably absurd. Look, if you're going to go get your brain operated on,
You're going to make the presupposition that there's a hierarchy of competence among brain surgeons that's independent of their desire for power, at least partly, and you're going to look for the best brain surgeon, just like you'd look for the best auto mechanic, or for the best plumber, or for the best carpenter. Like, anything that's worth doing, by nature, by definition, has a value structure implicit in it. And of course, if there are good carpenters, there are also people who aren't good carpenters. It's like prejudice to point that out. It's not prejudice to point that out. They're just not good carpenters. Luckily, they might be able to be good at something else. Well, so the postmodern notion is that value structures exclude, and that's why they exist. And then what we should do is flatten or eliminate the things, or more perversely, I would say, we should know that. And this is where the Marxism comes into it, and it's a very strange intellectual sleight of hand. Your identity is defined by your gender, or your sexuality, or whatever happens to be the identity issue du jour, and because you're identified with that identity, and other people are identified with other identities, there's no way of having a dialogue between them because, well, for the postmodernists, dialogue doesn't even exist. There's no way of developing a consensus between groups that are predicated on different identities. The whole idea of consensus through dialogue is actually a trick that was generated by the people who occupy the most dominant positions, and those are the phallocentric positions that Derrida was always on about. It's an interesting idea because value structures are prejudicial. There's no doubt about it. And one of the ways of thinking about that, you think you're not prejudiced. It's like, yeah. Do you sleep with anyone who asks you to? Now, some of you men might say, well, yes. And I don't get asked very often. But I'm making a very straightforward point here, is that in our most intimate relationships, we're precisely most prejudicial. And you want to take that away from people, or do you want to start noting that certain kinds of prejudices, let's say, in favor of things that are desirable or valuable, are actually an integral part of making intelligent choices. So, well, that was a bit rambly because I'm getting a bit tired.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay.
Do I have to stand on time?
No.
So, according to what you said earlier, you pointed out differences between men and women.
Yeah.
And their psychology.
Yeah.
And just following from what you said, it stands to reason that different ideas are going to resonate more with women versus men,
yep,
in general. So I'll give an example. Like women, I've heard studies that say women seek help from therapists a lot more than men do, which allows them to positively sublimate a lot of negative feelings they're experiencing and move through crisis a lot better than men do.
Yep.
That's one advantage that I feel they have on us. Another advantage we have generally is that we're a lot more emotionally composed and we can deal with traumatic, we can deal with like crazy situations a lot better, like emergency situations. We can keep our emotions controlled, less likely to panic. But to what extent do we indulge our natural propensities, both socially and legislatively, versus correcting them to absolute values? So what I'm asking then is, just because a man is less likely to seek help from a therapist,
yeah,
doesn't mean that that's good.
Yeah.
Right? Just because a woman's more likely to panic in a certain situation doesn't mean that's good. How do you streamline our values and judge everyone equally?
Okay, well, it's a very complicated question. So, but the essence of the question is that, this really isn't the central question, is that given that there are differences between men and women, let's say, to what degree should society be structured so that the negative consequences of those differences might be overcome? And the specific example was perhaps that women are more likely to seek medical attention and psychological help, which does happen to be the case, and that's perhaps beneficial, and it would be better if men were more prone to seek help as well when they have problems. We don't know, but we could assume that might be the case. Well, let me just think about that for a second here. See if I can figure out how to answer that properly. I think the way you start is by trying to figure out what the differences are first. You know, because I always think, I'm very leery of broad-scale social solutions because I think they're so low resolution that they tend to cause more trouble than they tend to cause more trouble than they forestall. We're just at the beginning of starting to understand what the differences between men and women actually are. You know, like the Scandinavian studies that I talked about, they're only about 15 years old. And it takes about 15 years for scientific information generally to sort of leach out into the general public if it's going to do so. And so the question of to what degree the differences between men and women exist and to what degree they're biological versus sociological is something that we're just starting to sort out. The next question might be, okay, well, what do we do in the face of those differences? And the answer to that is, like, I don't know what we should do about it. I do think that we should forego the temptation to jump to premature conclusions. And we have some real problems with this. So one of the things that's happening, and many of you may have noticed it, is that men are bailing out of the humanities and social sciences like math. You know, and this has been happening for about 15 years, 20 years. I mean, overall, enrollment in the humanities has declined substantially since the 1960s. And that's because I think that most of what's being padded is old, simplified, postmodern nonsense. I mean, it's very, very hard on people. They go there and they have whatever cherished assumptions they might have, fragmentary as they are, they bring to a humanities class and have those demolished. It's like a giant hits your raft with a hammer. We have an emerging problem, which is, well, what are we going to do when there's no men left in the humanities and the social sciences? Is that actually going to work? Because I'm not sure it'll work. I guess we're going to find out. You know, and then we have the converse problem, say, with regards to engineering and women. Is it women don't go into engineering? Well, should they? Well, the first question might be, who said that they should? And my sense is that what we should do is open up opportunities for people, because I think the idea of leveling the playing field to the degree that's possible to equalize opportunity is a good one from a sociological perspective, because you don't want talent to go to waste. Now, that doesn't mean that the way that's done commonly is intelligent or appropriate, because it often doesn't work at all, but it is best if we can open up society so that people can let their talents flourish. I would say we remove unreasonable prejudice to the degree that that's possible, and you do that by constraining it in your own life, and then you let people make their own decisions and let it sort out the way it will. And you know, you see that in Scandinavia, so that you have 19 female nurses to one male nurse and 19 male engineers to one female engineer. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's optimal. We don't know. But I think individuals should be the people that decide. So, do we have time for one more, or should we stop?
I think we're just about out of time.
All right.
So, big thanks to Dr. Peterson.